620 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. It is gorgeous outside, so I hope that you are able to enjoy some part of this beautiful sunshiny weather. I know there's lots of smiling people walking by the studio here on Michigan Avenue, basking in the sun. I hope you are able to do the same. My friends, lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be talking about Tesla, the automaker, not the guy. And so we're going to be talking about that and how the company valuation is mighty favorable right now. But we're going to talk with someone who says maybe we should not so fast there. We're going to take a look at what's really the deal and what's really driving that valuation. And is it possibly a bubble? We'll take a look at that. We'll also take a look at medical records and how, as things are becoming more and more digitized, how that poses a very particular security concern for users, for healthcare providers, for us all. So we're going to talk about all that good stuff. But right now, we are starting off the program with regular contributor to this show, Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, business reporter at Chicago Tribune, who joins us to talk today a bit about the minimum wage hike, which is a conversation that has been going on for quite a while nationwide and here in Chicago. Thanks for being with us today, Alexia.
My pleasure.
So you wrote a piece that is at ChicagoTribune.com. Everybody can head over there to ChicagoTribune.com and find this piece. It is lovely. And I really like how it starts with this kind of vignette of a person who is working in a suburban fast food location and kind of her feelings about her pay and where she started and what it's all about. But why right now did you choose to write about the minimum wage conversation, since it's been going on for quite a while with you know, various twists and turns? But why right now?
Yeah, you're right. It's nationally going on for quite a long time and at the state level too. But just a few weeks ago, there was a bill introduced in the House by Representative Will Guzzardi to raise the minimum wage for Illinois to $15 an hour. It's not the first such bill that's been proposed at the state level, but it's already passed. It's already been approved in the committee. The House is expected to vote on it perhaps this month. And it has a chance of, you know, making it through the Senate as well when it reaches, you know, the governor's desk. It's a whole other question. But it's top of mind right now in the state because there is a bill that is actually moving through.
Right. So in the data that you looked at, you were looking at some survey results, and it seemed like it wasn't as clear cut. You know, I think the common narratives associated with this is, of course, workers favor it, small business owners do not. But in fact, there was so much more nuance to that that you uncovered in the piece and in the data that you looked at for the piece. Can you talk us through some of that?
Yeah, so there was a small survey done of just 500 Illinois residents just to kind of take the temperature on what they feel about this hike. And it found that most people, two-thirds of people, don't think that a hike to $15 is going to happen. They don't think that it's going to be approved. And also, almost like about half of them don't think that it should be. And another 20% don't particularly care. So that leaves about a third of people who support it, which is not to say that they think things should stay as it is, because right now the minimum wage in Illinois is $8.25 an hour, which is more than the federal minimum wage. Most people who were surveyed said that they thought that it should be raised to $12. So it sounds like they were more skeptical of $15 as opposed to raising it at all.
And then as you were talking to businesses, it seems like there's quite a division between small businesses and particularly franchisees, not just someone associated with a corporation.
Yeah, I mean, so the business feeling generally is, you know, always that raising minimum wage is bad for them. Not everyone believes that. There are definitely businesses that agree with workers, advocates that think that raising the minimum wage is good and that higher wages make better workers and better product and better service and that their businesses benefit as a result. But for some small businesses, and particularly this Dairy Queen franchisee who I spoke with, he's really concerned that the math just doesn't work. That he had hit the number of employees he needs to put there on the front at $15, given his revenues, which are what they are. They don't go up. He feels like, you know, there's only a certain amount of demand for Blizzards. That it's just not, he just cannot absorb such a huge increase in his labor costs, and he's pretty sure he'd have to close as a result. So this bill does consider, take that into consideration, and it offers a tax credit for small business owners, but that does not include franchisees if that franchise has 10 or more locations, so Dairy Queen, McDonald's, et cetera. So people who small business owners, basically franchisees who own one location, two locations, they are not included in that tax credit if the franchise that they are working with is a big one.
So the person that you spoke to, the employee of this franchisee in Northbrook, this Dairy Queen employee, said something very curious in this piece, and I'd like to talk about that a bit. She was talking about her teenage daughter going to work, and she said she was uncomfortable if such a wage hike could be passed. She was uncomfortable with the idea of her 16-year-old making that much money out of the gate. What do you think propelled her to say that?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting as well. So here's the thing. So people think about minimum wage being teenage workers, right? Like at McDonald's or in fast food. And they're like, why does a teenager have to make that much money? And in the case of this particular worker, so this is the woman in the story. She's 48 years old. She's worked at Dairy Queen for a couple of years. She used to work in nursing, but then took a career break and came back, and she couldn't really have any options, so she landed at Dairy Queen. But anyways, she has a teenage daughter, and she's kind of thinking like, you know, she doesn't need to make $15 an hour. And if she did, she almost felt like she worried that it was like too much money. Like, you know, at that young of an age, is that too much responsibility to have, you know, that much money? And also there's a sense of like, why should she be making that much right out of the gate when I had to like, you know, work all these years like to barely get there? So there's a kind of sense of like, that's not fair. You know, why should I have worked all the time and made so much less when this teenager can make that same amount?
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting comment. So as we follow along with this issue, what are the most immediate milestones that we should be watching for?
Well, we should see what happens in the House to see if they vote on it and then where it goes, and then the Senate. And then really, I mean, what it'll hinge on the governor, who has stated in the past that he's not opposed to raising minimum wage. He's actually said he supports raising the wage, probably not to $15, probably something more modest, but that he wants it to be in the broader context of reducing other regulatory burdens on businesses. So it's going to be, you know, part of all this, you know, wonderful negotiating happening in Springfield about whether, you know, this goes anywhere. So those are kind of the political milestones that we have to watch. I mean, the wage in Illinois hasn't been raised in quite a few years. Costs have gone up. So for a lot of people who are making that much money, it's really kind of a matter of like, I cannot pay my bills. And I think one of the interesting things that's happened is that people who are making minimum wage now are older than they used to be. They're more educated than they used to be, and they're unable to move on from it. So like you think like, okay, well don't stay in that job for so long, get a better job, move up, become a supervisor, make more money. Studies show that like 70% of people who are making the minimum wage when they're 25 years old or older are still making within like 10% of the minimum wage 3 years later. So if you're making $8.25, you know, today, 3 years from now, you might be making, you know, $8.25 plus, you know, 82 cents, whatever. You might be making $9.05. Or something in several years. And so that's still a very low wage, and that still makes it difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is it's a complex one. I think sometimes we get caught up with the narratives around this topic, and it is really hot button. I mean, people do get really, really agitated about this topic, particularly when we're talking about business leaders versus workers. But nonetheless, I appreciate you breaking it down for us. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, business reporter at Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much. All right, we are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about Tesla. There's a lot of conversation going on right now, especially when we're looking at how Tesla has been valuated lately. And is it in a bubble? Maybe. I don't know. We're going to find out. We're going to talk with someone who really has a very strong opinion about that. So more to come here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots to do on the show today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking with a healthcare reporter at Cranes all about how, as we digitize our medical records, there are many, many security issues that come up with that. So we're going to be talking about that on the other side of news. But right now we're joined by John Wasik, who is a journalist and author of Lightning Strikes, Timeless Lessons in Creativity from the Life and Work of Nikola Tesla. Hi, John. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you have written a piece recently that is very, very interesting. A lot of conversation going on right now about who the person that that company was named for, and that is Tesla. And so the automaker Tesla, lots of people talking about them right now because suddenly the conversation is, oh, they're more valuable than GM. But you are calling shenanigans on that, as are a few other people in the financial world, saying that, in fact, let's break this down. This is what we're really talking about, is how Silicon Valley is really valuing innovation and the potential for disruption rather than actually the nuts and bolts of automaking. So take us through what you're observing.
Well, I think you have to be realistic and ask the question, why is Tesla the stock, even though it's only had two profitable quarters, why is it more than $300 a share? GM's $30 a share, and GM makes about $10 million cars a year, and Tesla only makes about 84,000. So what's wrong with this picture? So I asked some fundamental questions. It's like, well, how are they valuing the company? Well, investors are very optimistic. They think Tesla is going to be the car company in the future for self-driving cars. They see potential for the solar products integrating into that. But, you know, they have a lot of competition. GM's coming out with its Bolt model, electric EV, soon, and that's going to be another electric car. They can produce a lot more of them. And every major manufacturer has one or is going to produce one. So I think it's a little bit unrealistic.
Yeah, well, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal that was that mentioned Nagrant Research and how they were looking at just data alone shows that, in fact, Ford and GM are leading the autonomous car race. But it seems like, as you point out in the piece that you wrote about how investors tend to make very emotional decisions. And it seems like Elon Musk, who is the head of Tesla, has kind of made this name for himself in a way that it's having people pin their hopes on him as he's the guy that's going to disrupt the auto industry. When in fact we have, he's from Silicon Valley, when we have Ford and GM and those guys who are in the business of making and manufacturing and marketing cars. So I absolutely hear what you're saying there. And then there's also the possibility, it seems that as we're looking at the pricing, the Chevy Bolt that you mentioned and the Tesla Model 3, they're going to be around the same price. The Tesla perhaps will be a few thousand dollars less. But as we're looking to China and the electric cars that they are coming up with and that are coming up on the horizon from them, it seems like they will be the clear winner if people are buying those cars just for price alone.
Oh, absolutely. Once China gets into the market, provided there's no trade war going on that's going to prevent them from coming into this market, I think they're going to grab a lot of market share. I say it's analogous to what happened in the 70s and 80s when gas prices were sky high and GM wasn't ready with a small car, produced really bad ones. And then Toyota and Nissan came right into the market, grabbed market share, and really cleaned up. And they're still, you know, pretty much the leaders in those kinds of cars. Toyota was first in the hybrid market and gained a really good foothold, and a lot of other car makers have just been playing catch-up. So it's a matter of not who gets there first or who has the most cachet, and clearly Tesla has the most glamour of all of these companies. It's who has the staying power, who has the cash. Tesla's kind of short on cash right now, and they got to produce a lot of cars. They got 400,000 orders out there for Model 3. So, you know, there's a huge downside. It's like, what if they don't meet expectations? What if they don't meet their numbers? Then the downside's really steep.
Right. And plus, they're trying to get us to space, so they got to fund that, too.
Sure.
Lots of things going on there. And then the 5 points that you make in the piece that you wrote, the final two are kind of where we started this conversation. That's about the kind of the innovation factor and the glamour factor, because indeed, the Tesla is still kind of this, very sexy brand, and it's one that's very popular in Silicon Valley. And of course, as we were saying, a lot of people have pinned their hopes on Elon Musk as being this innovator and as kind of being this one who will save and completely change the auto industry.
Well, I think a lot of the changes have already happened, and the really major changes that are about to happen are really in battery technology. The actual motor itself has not changed that much in 100 years, but it's the computer innards, it's the battery. It's making those batteries lighter, less flammable, and actually, you know, storing more energy, and the charging infrastructure that has to go with it. That's the real nuts and bolts of all this, and really the advantage will be conferred to a company that can produce more of these cars at a lower cost and grab market share. So I'm not convinced that Tesla can do this.
Yeah, well, time will tell indeed. Thank you so much, John Wasik, journalist, speaker, and author of Lightning Strikes, Timeless Lessons in Creativity from the Life and Work of Nikola Tesla. You can read this piece. Go to Forbes.com and look for this piece. It is 5 Reasons Why Tesla is Bubble Priced. Thanks so much for being with us today, John.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff. And when we come back on the other side of news, we're going to be talking about medical records and digital access and security. More of that when we come back on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. I hope you are able to go outside and enjoy some of this lovely weather today. Lots of people walking by the Michigan Avenue Showcase Studio window, and everyone looks so darn happy in the sunshine. I love it. I love this time of year, so I hope you are able to enjoy some of it for yourself. Still lots to do here on the show today. We are joined now by Bridget Sweeney, who's a regular contributor to this program. She is healthcare reporter at Cranes. Hi, Bridget. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, so you've recently written about this kind of new area of concern as far as cybersecurity goes, and that is our medical records. And it is a really fascinating piece. I encourage everyone to go find it and read it because it is really interesting because it is a very nuanced area of this, because not only do our records need to be a little bit open so that our healthcare providers can access them and treat us, but then they need to be private because there's so much data in there about us. So break all this down for us and how you came across and why right now have you decided to write about this?
Absolutely, Amy. Well, the first thing is, I mean, I think as a journalist, we're constantly, you know, contacted by sources and by people who are concerned about various issues of security. So covering healthcare is something from a medical perspective that I've really just become more and more aware of over time. But the thing that I think I kept really top of mind is it's so easy to horrify people and myself. You know, as I report to lots of people, it's so scary. It's so easy for it to happen. There's so many players who are not properly insulated against the risks. But I think I think we try and really balance that with looking at what places are doing. And the good news is, you know, players from hospital systems to even, you know, private practice doctor's offices are getting better. The technology is getting better. The providers who kind of offer these electronic medical record systems are getting more secure. But the bottom line is that the medical field remains low-hanging fruit because unlike the retail and the banking world who kind of encountered this more than a decade ago and have really built up best-in-class systems, you know, hired the best and of the best in terms of cybersecurity professionals, the medical world is later to the game just because they have not always been a technologically savvy and intensive industry.
So you pointed to a statistic in this piece that I thought was really, really quite shocking. And that was so far in 2017, 79 security breaches, each affecting at least 500 patients, have been reported to the U.S. Health and Human Services Department. So that's about 5 incidents a week so far this year. That seems very high, but it also is not something I think we're hearing about as much. We tend to hear about breaches of security when they're very widespread, when they have a huge, huge impact, not so much when they're a few hundred people at a time.
Exactly. And again, as you said, it is a shocking statistic, and it does show just how widespread these problems are. That said, I think a lot of these breaches, you know, it shows a hole in a system's security, whether that's an outside hacker, you know, managing to get in through kind of a phishing scheme through any employee, or if it's an internal and an employee winds up, you know, stealing some records. The good news is that for the vast majority of these breaches, it's remains pretty clear that no patient data was actually sold or used nefariously, but it was just breached. It was either open to being taken or taken, but then nothing was ever actually done with it. The number is quite shocking.
Well, I think that is an important thing to kind of define and mention. When we talk about a breach, we suddenly think, I think that like the consumer tendency is to go, oh my gosh, my entire body of information is out there. I'm completely exposed. But oftentimes that could be simply your email address. Sometimes that's not something that's necessarily that high stakes anyway. And I think that's kind of an important thing to define when we talk about a breach of data.
Absolutely. And actually, one of the best known breaches, or I guess that's kind of not the right term to use, but the biggest breach that we've kind of encountered in the Chicago area is when Advocate Healthcare wound up having three separate breaches back in 2013. They wound up just paying $5.5 million to Health and Human Services as a settlement for potential violations of federal patient privacy law. But anyway, these incidents do involve stolen employee laptops. And that shows just how, you know, the system is doing its best to keep things as secure as they can. But if you have a high-level executive on a Metro train and someone grabs their laptop and it's not properly secured, you know, boom. So anyway, that said, it was a huge, there were thousands and thousands of records stolen, but the hospital said, you know, there's no indication the information was misused. So again, it's really hard because it could be just an email address, it could be your phone number, it could be your home address. But then at the other extreme, it could be your policy number, you know, your insurance number. And there have been instances, I didn't come across many in Illinois, but there have been instances where, you know, on an individual level, people all of a sudden start getting billed for medical services they certainly never received, because these are literally just taking people's insurance information to actually have their own, you know, surgery or procedure or something that without insurance quite expensive, and they're literally just billing it to the other person's insurance.
But then there's the issue of devices in particular that are, it's not just the billing system and the content, you know, the record management system that's vulnerable. You mentioned in this piece that you wrote, this was so interesting, how even insulin pumps and pacemakers could be vulnerable, and how Dick Cheney, when he was vice president, he revealed later that doctors disabled the wireless connection of his pacemaker because of fear of an assassination attempt.
Right, absolutely, Amy. And that's, again, that's where things kind of delve into the really, really, like, almost science fiction scary, scary, scary stuff. It certainly is an issue. And for someone of, you know, a vice presidential level, you know, someone who is a target to possibly terrorism or outside forces, it's a very real issue. Most of the experts who I spoke to said this is very real. These wireless connections make these devices vulnerable, but it's not in the interest of cyber thieves. It's not their top priority to do this just to someone in the general public. You know, it would be more of like a targeted, be extremely rare, extremely high-level person, probably in the U.S. government. That said, Johnson & Johnson, you know, recently warned customers about a security problem with one of their insulin pumps for the same reason, just because, you know, it's not even if someone is purposely targeting you, but if there's some kind of, you know, problem and everything goes offline and something crashes, that, again, could affect the efficacy of the pump, which, as we know, you know, is vital to the millions of people who have type 1 diabetes.
Certainly. And another issue that you point out in the work that you've done around this is about how this issue is kind of compounded, because often these record management systems in physicians' offices, in hospitals, are really quite clunky. They're not a lot of very sleek and easy to deal with, you know, systems there. And so to get around that, you have personnel just in the name of speed using email, using text, using things like that that are not as secure, just to communicate and make the work go faster.
Absolutely. And this is actually an even thornier problem, just because, as we all know, healthcare is so complicated. It's in the middle of this incredibly messy revolution. From a technology standpoint, you know, most of us know that under Obama, you know, there were electronic medical records and guidelines that went into effect. So all of these doctors and providers, whether they were a single person private practice or, you know, a 1,000 doctor big health system. They all had to, you know, make everything electronic. And so the big players have been using systems like Epic, which doctors still complain. They still think they're great, but they are considered best in class. They are quite expensive, and the big systems who have the budget pay for that. On the other end of the spectrum, you have small primary care practices, small specialty practices. Each of the specialties, I've been told by doctors, they can't afford Epic. So they have these little different electronic medical record providers who kind of have a niche in a specific specialty, and they all have different levels of, you know, how secure they are, how it works, what happens. And so there's no general guidelines or no general best-in-class rules and provider across the medical industry. Very fragmented. It's very easy for hackers to find vulnerabilities.
It's a very, very interesting and complex issue, and I really appreciate you breaking it down for us. And I really, really appreciate your very thoughtful care to be to kind of put that caveat out there of, like, I don't want to freak people out. We do need to talk about this, but let's not all go nuts at once. So I appreciate that very much.
I tell myself that because I get kind of freaked out when I do some of this reporting too. But all the experts also kind of add that caveat and are very clear that definite issue. We need to be better about it. We need to be very vigilant, but it's not something that's going to imminently ruin all of our lives.
Indeed. Thank you so much for being with us. Bridget Sweeney, healthcare reporter at Cranes. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
All right. We are going to take a little break. When we come back, more to come on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Coming up at 1 o'clock, we're going to turn things over to Scott Catoon for the Startup Showcase. He'll be telling you all about what's going on in the startup world here in Chicago. Always look forward to that one. You know, lately, a couple of brands have had some problems, which I think is possibly a major understatement, right? We've certainly seen a lot coming from United Airlines, both in the incident with the passenger on the plane that was captured on cell phone video and widely viewed, resulting in very severe injuries for that passenger, as well as the response from CEO Oscar Munoz that also drew a lot of criticism. Before that, Pepsi also really, really had some issues when they pulled an ad, I don't even think 24 hours after they put it up, in which one of the, what is it, Kylie or Ken, which Jenner is it, Griffin?
It was Kendall.
Kendall. They're all K Jenner.
How dare you?
I cannot keep my Kardashian Jenner people straight. I really cannot.
Fine. I think that's okay.
Call it a character flaw, but that's not a thing. I busy myself with many things, and that's not one of them. So anyway, she was shooting a commercial as the ad opens, and then whips off the blonde wig and wipes off her lipstick bravely and, you know, starts participating in a protest and offers a Pepsi to a cop. And I would say the least threatening and authoritative looking cops I've ever seen, all the supermodel cops.
And the Vegas protest. I mean, this is all pretty old by now, but yeah. There was no...
Nothing. Like somebody was holding a sign that just said, love. Like,
join the conversation.
Sure. Right.
Things like that.
Which is, as Stephen Colbert pointed out, a corporate slogan, not so much a protest sign.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, there were people that believed that it maligned and made fun of and lightened and, you know, just generally was rude and in bad form, given how many protest groups are working very hard right now in a time of political unrest, particularly the Black Lives Matter movement. So they pulled that ad really quickly because the internet was losing its mind over it, which I believe was the right call to do because I thought it was not in great taste. But there was another ad that kind of flew under the radar around this time because we were too busy with, you know, Pepsi and United. And that was a Burger King ad. And so it's props for creativity. Let's give them that. So essentially, what the ad does, in case you did not see it, is a guy comes up and he speaks right into the camera and he's asking about the Whopper, and because he is trying to trigger your Google Home device.
Yes, it's a friendly looking Burger King employee. He says, I don't have enough time to tell you why the Whopper is so good, or something to that effect. Like 30 seconds just isn't enough. So the last thing he says is, Google, what is the Whopper burger? And that is supposed to trigger your Google Home device to then tell you to start reading from the first line of the Wikipedia entry on the Whopper. And then it will just describe what the Whopper is. And that's sort of extended ad time for
them. It is a burger manufactured by Burger King. Like, I don't even know what the... I've never looked at the Wikipedia entry for the Whopper, but I'm sure...
What? I know. What have you been doing?
Again, I don't know my Kardashians. I don't read the Wikipedia entry for burgers. I don't know. My life counts for nothing, Griffin. But nonetheless, again, the internet kind of exploded. There was one commenter that said, hey, you know what? If you, when you take over someone's phone or tablet or whatever device and you have it and have it do your own remote commands intentionally, you are hacking, said one comment. So people got very upset about this. I think it's I absolutely see those points. I think it is a very creative use of technology. Yeah. Like, you're using an old medium, television, to trigger a very new technology to access a middle technology, and that is a Wikipedia entry. That's interesting.
Spanning all that.
Yeah, I do think there's some ethical concerns there. You have just triggered a device in my home to do something.
But all they've really done is just, they haven't hacked anything necessarily. I don't know. I feel tricky.
Yeah, hacking is a strong word, but I do think...
No, but people are very already concerned about those devices sort of... The Google Home itself got in a little bit of not trouble, but people were raising concerns like this when the day the Beauty and the Beast came out. There was something that was perceived as an ad for Beauty and the Beast coming unsolicited from people's Google Homes.
Oh, that would freak me out.
And they claimed that it was just letting you know what the news of the day was, like, this is coming out. People perceived that as an advertisement. They're like, this
I want
is
that
more
my house.
I see this as a personal assistant, not something to... bombard me with advertising in my home, you know.
Sure.
So that's sort of a gray area that they've already sort of delved into. So they're, I think Google especially was a little sensitive to this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So then I think it was just a couple hours after the ad first aired, the Google Home had been programmed to no longer to respond.
Yeah,
when
within
prompted.
Like 3 hours, Google was like, nope.
By that Burger King commercial, what is the Whopper burger? But it did respond if you would just ask it that same question. So they had, I guess, use the voice, the specific voice and like audio clip from the commercial and deactivated that somehow.
Meanwhile, that actor that's in that ad just wants to know when he keeps asking his, and it's ignoring.
Yeah,
the
I think
heck
it was just an honest question that he wanted answered.
He, no, he was like, well, no, I want to know. Yeah.
So this was,
I think that's a very interesting, I mean, it is very creative, but it's one of those, I don't know that I'm going to come down on one side of it because
I think
it's nuanced.
I do just think it's funny that this little, it's just Burger King, like up against in quotes, Google. And I like the idea of Google as this monolith sort of swatting Burger King away like a fly, like, oh, why stop messing with me?
Right.
And Burger King kind of has a history of doing advertisements like this that are, you know, cheeky and fun.
Right.
And people are also weirded out by. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the king, the mascot king they used to have, people found him very creepy.
Very creepy.
But
especially
I also thought it was pretty funny.
Yes, especially when he did the Baby Got Back remake in which there were like square burger boxes.
Right.
Down the back of someone's pants. Like they had, like when he was saying, because you got buns, hun. Like he meant
so weird.
Literal burger bun, right, and burger boxes. And it was just like, I don't even know if I'm supposed to be offended or what's going on.
Yeah,
just
they do
weird.
Seem to have always been in the game of just getting in your head no matter what way. And this seems to be that kind of thing too. But it did get drowned out by the other seemingly more egregious screw-ups. And they seem to think this wasn't even really a screw-up. I don't know if the ad is still running and it doesn't work as intended. So that could be seen as a failure. But the CEO put out a statement saying, you know, people are talking about it. That's what we wanted.
Yeah,
so,
job done.
You know.
My work here is done by.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, interesting. My phone sometimes, if I'm particularly, irritated by something, sometimes I will start a sentence with the word seriously in a loud and exasperated way. And I've triggered Siri on my phone by saying, seriously?
Now, do you have a Google Home or a Alexa or one of those things?
I don't. I have played with an Alexa before. I think they're really interesting.
It's fun for like 30 minutes to be in somebody's house if they have one. But then the person that actually has one will probably, in my experience, has been annoyed with me because I keep asking it to do things that it doesn't really need to do.
Right. The people that I know that have those devices, they say they get the most use out of them to order things, so they don't have to, like, by the time you go across the room to write it down on your list, like, if you're in the middle of laundry, you can just be like, Alexia, or Alexa, that was our guest earlier. Alexa, I wonder if she's got one. Alexa, order more detergent, and it'll just go to your Amazon. I think they'll use it that, so you don't have to stop the task or to put on a song right then. Like, Google, play so-and-so by so-and-so on Spotify.
Yeah.
Which would be kind of cool, but I can't really justify dropping a couple $100 for...
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah. Not yet. Give it time. Give it time. They'll find some reason why I need that in my life so much, but for now... I'll just write it down. I'll just open the app. It'll be fine. It'll be all good. Well, that about does it for us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to chat with Scott Catoon from the Startup Showcase here in just a bit, but let us take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff on 720 WGN.